Title IX became law in June of 1972. The act guarantees gender equality in education, but the greatest impact has been seen in sports. Today, Title IX at 40. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll take a look at how life in the United States and even around the world has changed since Title IX became law. I'll talk with Christine Grant. She is the former and only athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department. Pam Creedon is a professor emeritus of the University of Iowa School of Journalism. She also had a front row seat when Title IX took effect. And Lisa Bluter, the head coach of the University of Iowa women's basketball team, will be here as well. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1972, Title IX was signed into law. It says, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. It was part of education legislation, but 40 years later, the greatest impact of the act has been felt in the world of sports. This hour, we'll be exploring the effects of Title IX, opening up a world of athletics for women and girls, and we'll talk about some of the compromises that have been a result as well. Later this hour, I'll talk with Pam Creedon. She's a professor emeritus of the University of Iowa School of Journalism. Lisa Bluter will be here. She's head coach of the women's basketball team at the University of Iowa. I'll also talk with Troy Dannon, athletic director of the University of Northern Iowa. He's also the former executive director of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. And we want to hear from you this hour. How has Title IX affected your life? My first guest today is Christine Grant. She is the former and only athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department. She retired from that position in the year 2000. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Let's talk about when you became a graduate student at the University of Iowa. This is in the 1960s. What did you see in the world around you that surprised you? Because you came here from Scotland.
I came here from Scotland via Canada, yes.
Okay.
I had grown up as an athlete. My parents encouraged me to participate, and I thought every young girl had that opportunity. And I played throughout college in Scotland, and then I decided to go to Canada. And in Canada, I became involved in international field hockey, which was a highlight of my life, and loved it. Absolutely. Anyway, I decided I really had to go back to school and get a graduate degree. I chose the University of Iowa and came here, and one of the first things I did was go to a football game, and I nearly fell over. I mean, I had never seen anything like that in college sports. You know, the crowds, the excitement. And I started looking into the kinds of opportunities that a young man had at the university and was blown away by them. But when I researched what young women had at the university, I found out they only had club sports, which shocked me because the discrimination was so rampant, so overt. And I started talking to people about why this was the case, why the men had such wonderful opportunities, and the young women had almost, well, they had nothing that was comparable. And so I was told that women were not interested in sport, which came as news to me. And I was thinking back to my young years as an athlete and my years as a coach internationally, and I just could not believe that people truly believed women were not interested in sport. The timing of coming to Iowa was perfect because it was 1969. And I concentrated on my studies for a few years. And then I became involved. I was asked to coach the women's field hockey team, a club team, which actually I helped finance.
Oh, wow.
As a graduate student.
Uh-huh.
And just became really involved in looking at the comparisons. And it just so happened that Title IX was passed in 1972. And I thought, well, everything's solved, you know. We're just going to immediately have exactly the same thing for our young women.
For a number of the people who were involved in passing Title IX, they have said, you know, sports was not really on our minds.
It was not.
Right. So when you heard about the passage, did sports immediately come to your mind?
Did you think?
Okay.
Absolutely. I should also say that when Title IX was passed, the most important thing was the opening up of all of the educational opportunities for girls and women. It was not sport. I mean, if I have to really stress this, it's very important because women back then were denied the opportunities to enroll in certain colleges. Or if they were allowed to enroll, it was a very, very small quota. So it was the opening of all of our colleges, you know, the College of Medicine, the College of Law, the College of Dentistry, the College of Engineering, to women. That was the most important thing about Title IX. But, as you know, the battle for Title IX has all been about sport because the universities moved immediately to change their admission standards and make them the same for men and women, to change everything about the academe to make it equal opportunity. But it's sport where the resistance has come.
So really, in some ways, when you thought all the problems are solved, it really was a very swift reaction to Title IX that evened out a lot of educational opportunities for women in the United States. But you became athletic director for the Women's Athletic Department at the University of Iowa in 1973, so a year after Title IX has taken effect. When you took that position, what was women's athletics like at the University of Iowa?
Club sports, period. The students themselves helped finance the sporting experience. The people who were coaching coached for nothing and actually helped finance the teams. It was the Women's Physical Education Department that helped us organize, that actually did the organization for the club sports and provided equipment where they could and uniforms such as they were. So it was very low-key, very, very inexpensive efforts. I know Troy's coming on the program, and I should say that one of the things I do remember when I was coaching the field hockey team, we went up to UNI. They beat us, by the way. And we slept on the gymnasium floor. That's what it was like back prior to Title IX.
Wow. So when you took that role and you didn't have much to work with, what did you set out to do? How did you build an athletic department for women?
Well, I had, I think, the best president in the entire United States to work with, President Sandy Boyd. He was so far ahead of his time for equal opportunity for women. And when he heard about Title IX, he immediately said, we are going to elevate 12 women's club sports right up to varsity status. And we're also going to advertise for an athletic director. And so everything kicked into gear in the early fall of 1973. The budget, the entire budget for our department at that year was $30,000, which is truly unbelievable, isn't it? But we knew that we were on the verge of a revolution. I think we were aware of that because we had found out that colleges and universities were supposed to be in compliance by 1978. You know, they were given 3 years. After the implementation in 1975. So we thought that things were going to change very quickly, and they did. I mean, every year was entirely different to the previous year.
So did you get to select what 12 sports would be part of the athletic department?
Well, there were only 12 clubs.
There were only 12 sports, okay.
Yeah.
And as they were elevated to varsity level, did you have to set out to recruit young women to be a part of this?
Well, actually, the young women who were in the club sports mainly were in the physical education department. And so it was the same women who had been playing club sports who just were elevated up to varsity status because we were doing no recruiting the first couple of years. You know, it was a case of trying to make a huge transition from club level to varsity level and plan out.
Right. I imagine that there were probably young women who were playing more than one sport if they were playing at the club level.
Absolutely.
So I would guess a lot of your varsity teams had the same players on them?
Oh, yes. Actually, I thought that was a good thing. I'm not a huge believer in specialization in sport. I was a three-sport athlete, and I'm kind of biased toward that.
What were your three sports?
Something akin to basketball. It was called netball and field hockey and track.
Mm-hmm. As you built this department and started trying to find other teams to compete against, was that difficult to find other teams that you could travel and play?
Oh, no, because we had pretty good teams in the state of Iowa. And at that time, we were all in the same boat. You know, right now, in 2012, we've got all of these divisions and subdivisions of competition. Back then, in 1972, we were all at the same level. So, you know, we could go and play Grinnell, Luther, UNI, you know, the schools that were nearby. And that's what we did. And we had very good games because the teams were competitive. UNI was particularly good because they had a huge physical education department.
As time went on, of course, you saw more and more women coming to college who had gotten to play sports in high school and junior high. How did you see the landscape change as you saw women coming to college who had been playing sport for 5, 10 years even?
Well, first of all, I should explain that in the 60s and the early 70s, young women in our society were actively discouraged from playing. It was not acceptable for young women to sweat. Now, can you imagine playing sport well and not sweating? There was a taboo against excellence for women in sport in our society. So that had to change. That was the first thing that had to change. And young girls and young women had to, in some cases, defy their parents and their friends, and really set out to strive for excellence. That was a huge step forward. I had difficulty coaching our field hockey club team because they wouldn't train, you know? And I didn't understand that. But I later realized that they were fighting a whole attitude of our society. And looking back now, we have done a phenomenal job of changing society in a very short period of time. Look at the last Olympics.
Right. We'll talk about that in
a
moment.
Really.
Yeah, we need to take a short break. I'm talking with Christine Grant. She is the former athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department. We're talking about Title IX at 40. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about Title IX. Title IX was signed into law 40 years ago this summer in 1972, and the intention of the law was to do away with gender discrimination in education. Of course, we all know now the greatest impact, perhaps, of this legislation has been in sports, or at least that has certainly generated the most conversation and the most controversy over the last 40 years. My guest is Christine Grant. She is the former and only athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department. She retired from that position in the year 2000. She took that role on in 1973. So she was there at the forefront when Title IX was being enacted. Also joining us now is Pam Creedon. She's professor emeritus at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's also the author of The Edge of Change, Women in the 21st Century Press and Women, Media, and Sport Challenging Gender Values. Pam, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about your background with regard to sports.
Well, it's a very interesting background, I would say. When I was in high school, I was president of what was then the Girls Athletic Association. When I was in college, I was president of what was then the Women's Recreation Association. But just like we just heard from Christine, we played a little bit of everything. Every individual played multiple sports whenever we had any kind of activity with another school. When we were in college, we had a basketball gymnasium where we were literally the whole gymnasium was a half court. So, and we were allowed to do three dribbles and pass.
You were playing 6-on-6.
No. Well, yes, we were. Okay. You're absolutely correct. We were 6-on-6, but we weren't allowed to cross the center line. We could do three dribbles and then pass, and eventually we were allowed to have one player cross the center court line and actually do a little bit more. So it was a long and kind of interesting past in order to understand women's athletics and women's sports, but it was something I was interested in from the very beginning, obviously.
Christine was just talking about how the culture at the time really discouraged physical activity for young women. You weren't supposed to get sweaty and get dirty. I remember my mom telling me that her mother told her not to run because she would hurt her delicate female parts. So did you hear a lot of those kind of things when you were a young athlete?
I think I was a little bit independent of some of that. I don't recall hearing a lot of it. I can recall, however, having my sister, if anyone wanted me, for example, to be on the baseball or softball team, they had to take my sister, too, to make us equal. So I think in the community I grew up in, we were allowed to have a lot more opportunities, and that could be why I became so much more interested in women's sports. I did once on monkey bars have my skirt pulled off by a male who was on the other side who was competing with me, but I did run home to get that changed.
What were you doing when Title IX took effect?
When Title IX took effect, I was the director of public information, now public relations, at a small private college in Ohio. And when that happened, after I realized that we had no uniforms, we had no coaches for any of the women's teams, I found a woman who was a seamstress in town. This is a town in Ohio. I don't want to mention the college because I know they're still a little embarrassed about this. I hired a seamstress, and I had her actually sew together the uniforms for a women's softball team. And because she had done that, and we paid her actually out of the public information budget at this university, and or college, university now, we had her be the coach. And frankly, the first time we played any intercollegiate sports, this is a small private college with 1,200 students in Ohio, we played Ohio State.
Oh, wow. So you saw things change, I'm sure, just as Christine was there on the front lines, as suddenly all these club sports were elevated to varsity level and women started really competing at the collegiate level. What changes did you see?
Oh, enormous changes. I think one of the things that I've noticed most recently, of course, was the Olympics, where finally we have every country competing in the Olympics at least have one or more women athletes.
And this is the very first Olympics where there has been a woman from every single country.
Absolutely. This is the very first Olympics. Qatar, Brunei, and Saudi Arabia were the last three countries in the world that wanted to compete in the Olympics that actually brought women into competition. And there's one interesting dynamic to this, too. For example, Kuwait was the first time they had a woman in the Olympics. She was a student at Michigan State. Libya, the first time that they had a woman in the Olympics in 2008, she went to the University of Florida. And in 2012, one of the first women from Saudi Arabia is a student at California Pepperdine. So I think there's some reaction or some relationship between what we've been able to do with Title IX in terms of the globe, in terms of what's going on for women's sports around the world.
I'd like to jump in there because I'm thinking of writing a paper on this very topic. We think that Title IX has had an enormous effect on our nation, and it has a phenomenal effect, especially in academics, as I mentioned. But I do believe that Title IX has been influencing the entire world through sport, and that is amazing. When you stop and think about it, I've been tracking what's happening to women in the Olympic Games, and you can see the figures just rising rapidly after 1972. And it's the USA that is in the leadership role in this. And, you know, the last Olympics, our women won nearly two-thirds of the gold medals and nearly 60% of all of the medals. And we've been showing the rest of the world, particularly since 1996. Remember the games in Atlanta, how excited we all were about that? I think other nations were looking at the U.S. and saying, their women are walking away with medals. Maybe we should be bringing women to the Olympics. And that's what's been happening. And isn't that great?
Well, and when you talk about 1996, one of the really remarkable things about that Olympic Games was that most of the women who were participating in those games from the United States really didn't know a world before Title IX.
That's correct. They called themselves the Title IX babies. Remember the soccer team? They were particularly vocal about being Title IX babies. And that really helped, I think, push our nation forward to closer to equality. And it certainly, in my opinion, influenced the world.
I want to talk more about Title IX today and how you see gender equality in athletics right now, at this moment in time, in 2012. But I want to bring Lisa Bluter into the conversation first. Lisa Bluter is the head coach of the University of Iowa women's basketball team. Hello, Lisa.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being on the show again.
Oh, I'm pleased to be part of this.
Now, you sort of walk the line here. You started playing sports after Title IX, right?
That's correct. I was in high school from 75 to 79, so I'm of the generation that has probably benefited the most from Title IX. And now, obviously, going into the career of athletics, to see it continue to grow, and we still have some work to do, but to see it continue to grow has been amazing.
When you were playing in high school, you were playing basketball in Marion?
That's
in
correct.
Iowa?
I went to Lynn Mar High School in Marion.
All right.
And played basketball, softball, volleyball, tennis, track. I did it all.
Were you aware of how things had changed in just the few years before you were there?
You know, I was. We played the 6-on-6 style of basketball back then. And I remember having practices, and after the practices, our coaches polling us and taking surveys whether we wanted to switch to 5-on-5 or we wanted to stay to 6-on-6. And I remember I was one of the few girls that wanted to go 5-on-5 because I wanted to go and play in college. And, you know, I loved this game, and I wanted to take it even farther than I was being allowed to take it at that time. And so it was just interesting to see how times have changed so much from me being the only one that really wanted to change back then to now everybody kind of laughing when they think about the 6-on-6 game and how that kind of held us back from being full athletes.
And then you went to UNI?
Correct. I went to the University of Northern Iowa, and again, I was one of the first that benefited from scholarships there. I was among the first classes to receive scholarships. Now, back then, we didn't get full scholarships, though. I got a half scholarship to play basketball, but this is kind of alarming when you think about it. A half scholarship back then was $1,100. So the whole entire year of tuition, room, and fees at UNI back then was $2,200. So that we've come a long ways there, too, haven't we?
Well, certainly, that's for a different day, I think.
Yeah.
When you were playing basketball in college, again, you know, this was in really the decade after Title IX had
Correct.
Taken effect. Did you feel like the program there was getting the same kind of support as the men's basketball program?
Oh, no. There were so many areas that we saw as female athletes that, you know, the men's team had better off than we did. I mean, we were driving in vans and sleeping four in a room, and they were sleeping two in a room and having charter buses take them places. And, you know, we had one set of uniforms, and we were assigned to the court that was kind of the lesser court when we had practice at the same time. And it was just they got books paid for. We didn't get our books paid for. So there were so many areas that you could still see that we had work to do with Title IX.
At the same time, I'm sure you felt really lucky to be there, to have a half scholarship and to be playing ball. Did you feel frustrated because you saw the inequities, or was that something that you weren't focusing on at the time?
You know, we were frustrated. We did notice it, and it was very frustrating, but we loved the opportunity to play, and we were getting the opportunity to play, and just you know, put our efforts more in that than getting too upset about what the men were getting when we weren't getting.
So here you are in 2012. You're the head coach for the women's basketball team at the University of Iowa. You have young women coming into your program who, of course, have never known a world before Title IX. Do you think that they understand what Title IX did for them, or is this something that is just taken for granted today?
I think it's taken for granted today, and I think that's unfortunate. And that's why I would love to have Dr. Grant come in and talk to our team about every 3 years so that they get an idea of how far we've come, but also how far we still need to go. And so, Dr. Grant is just wonderful at explaining this to young people and helping them understand. And I think then they have a greater appreciation of what people have done before them, but they don't know. And so we have to keep telling them, we have to keep expressing it to them because, you know, they don't maybe value that ability to just be able to play that we, you know, and people before me certainly fought for.
What do you see as the inequities today? What kind of work do we still have to do to achieve gender equality in sports?
Well, I mean, the number one thing is participation and just being able to give women opportunities to participate in sport. We're still not even at 50-50 here at the University of Iowa, although it's getting better. And I don't want to lose hope or anything like that. It is getting better, but, you know, how long have we worked on this and we're still not there? But to me, that's the number one thing is just the opportunity to play. Because once we give women an opportunity to play, they jump at it. And they need to have the opportunity to learn the lessons that they learn on the courts and on the fields that our men have been getting for years and years and years. And those lessons are going to help them when they go out into the workplace and help them get better jobs and more promotions. And we just can't take those opportunities away. So that's what I think is the number one thing is opportunity.
And you mentioned how your players take it for granted now that they get to play college basketball. Are we still doing the work that we need to do, or have we all become complacent?
Well, I think we need to teach the younger generation so they don't become complacent. You know, Dr. Grant has done so much work in this area, and we need to have the next generation carry that banner. We need that next generation to be able to understand so we don't go backwards.
Lisa, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Lisa Bluder is the head coach of the University of Iowa women's basketball team. And Christine, let me ask you, today, have we come to a point where we've achieved gender equality in sports at the collegiate level?
Absolutely not. I know that we have seen phenomenal progress, and I always want to say that up front and stress that fact. But we have a long way to go. I agree totally with Lisa regarding the next thing we've got to do, and that is increase the opportunities for our girls and our young women. I'm going to tell you a shocking statistic. Today, in 2012, the number of girls who are participating in high school sport has not yet reached the number of boys who were participating in 1972.
Wow.
Isn't that shocking?
Why do you think that is?
Because we have become complacent. We have not been enforcing Title IX for the last 12 years. High schools and colleges know this, and unless the university or high school is truly committed to equal opportunity, nothing is getting done. And we have seen in the last decade significantly more participation opportunities being given to boys and to men than to women. And that is in total defiance of a federal law. You know, at the high school level, our young girls have got 1.3 million participation slots less than their counterparts. 1.3 million. They're at 41% when the high school population is roughly 50-50. And at the collegiate level, we're not much better. I think overall, we're at 43%. When the undergraduate population is around 56%. We are a long, long way from where we ought to be. And I'm sad about that. I'm sad because I know what sport can give to young people. It gave to me. We are shortchanging our girls and women, and we must stop doing that.
What do you think needs to be done?
Enforce Title IX and get people who are in educational institutions to become really committed to providing equal opportunity. You know, we've done it in all areas of academe except sport. I get frustrated a little bit because I had dreamed back in the 70s that we were going to be in compliance by the end of the decade. And here we are, almost 40 years later, and we're still not in compliance.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Christine Grant. She is the former and only athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department. She took up that role in 1973, right after Title IX was passed. Also with me, Pam Creedon, a professor emeritus at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. They'll both stay with us. We're also going to bring Troy Dannon into the conversation. He's the director of athletics at the University of Northern Iowa. We're going to talk about some of the controversy surrounding Title IX in just a moment as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about Title IX at age 40. And with me today, Christine Grant. She is the former and only athletic director of the University of Iowa Women's Athletic Department, a role she played from 1973 to the year 2000. Also with me is Pam Creedon. She's professor emeritus at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And now we're welcoming to the conversation Troy Dannon. He's the director of athletics at the University of Northern Iowa and the former executive director of the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. Hello, Troy.
Hi there.
Thank you for being here today.
You bet. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Troy, when you came to UNI in 2008, one of your goals, really a mandate for you, was to bring UNI into compliance with Title IX. What did you see when you arrived there that was not in compliance with Title IX? What was the problem?
You know, there are three ways in which they allow you to measure compliance with Title IX, and I've never believed in surveys so much because I fear that surveys could be tainted in the way that they were drafted. And you and I had typically used surveys in order to justify its being in compliance with the requirements of Title IX, and the idea of continuing to show expanded opportunities. You and I really didn't have a good history of that. We'd added soccer, but it had been over a decade. So I was really trying to get us into some type of proportional compliance. When I walked in the door at UNI, the student body is 58% female at Northern Iowa, and so my goal was to get us into the upper 50s from a percentage of our total participants who were female. And we were about 19% under that when I walked in the door. So it's been a matter, especially in a time of budget issues. I came in with the idea that I was going to add a sport, and it quickly became apparent financially I was not going to add a sport. But it's how can I make sure that I manage the opportunities that we had here to get us as close to being in compliance as possible.
There are a lot of people who have criticized Title IX over the years as not just creating more opportunities for women, but taking away opportunities for men. We have an email on that subject from Jeff in Cedar Rapids. He says, would your guests address the numerous male non-revenue sports that have been eliminated by schools in order to comply with Title IX? Many schools no longer field teams in wrestling, soccer, and cross country and have limited the number of scholarships available to men's sports such as baseball and soccer in order to free up scholarships for women athletes in sports that often have limited demand. At my school, they had open tryouts on campus to fill spots on the volleyball and girls soccer teams just a year after cutting the number of available scholarships available to men. How is this fair? And Troy, I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to respond to that. But Troy, right after you became the athletic director at UNI, you had to cut the baseball team.
I did. And you know, we we had a major financial crisis where we lost $1 million in funding, and so I had to cut on economics, and I made the cut though. The only way Title IX factored into that decision was, as I look at how do I make my cuts, how do I make sure I remain in compliance with not just Title IX, but all of the other rules, regulations, laws, federal, state, the NCAA, how do I do that and still cut this money? And obviously when we're 19% off of where we should be proportionality, I was not going to eliminate female opportunities. And, you know, to the point that the email makes, one of the things that has always infuriated me about, and I've seen it with wrestling ever since I came to Northern Iowa, that the Wrestling Coaches Association constantly blames Title IX for the demise of wrestling. Title IX has nothing to do with the demise of wrestling. The demise of wrestling is because, one, wrestling has not advocated or promoted itself well nationally, and two, was institutions allocating their own internal resources, not to other male sports, but more heavily in those sports such as football and men's basketball, where there's going to be more revenue generated. And so to blame women's sports has been one of the biggest frauds that could ever be conspired in college athletics. It's a matter of the total dollars being reallocated within the men's side that hurts sports like wrestling and some of the other non-revenue men's sports as opposed to a piece of legislation.
Christine, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on this subject as well, because Jeff is not alone in his criticism. This is something that I'm sure you have heard time and time again.
Yes, I have. First of all, I want to say to Troy how appreciative I am of what you just said, because there are very few people who are willing to say that Title IX is not the culprit in this area. And you have nailed what the culprit is. It is the escalating costs in football and men's basketball, which none of us can keep up with. In my research, I discovered that about 25 years ago, football and basketball had about 50% of the budget that was allocated for their sports, 50%. So 50% was left for all of the other men's sports. Do you know what that figure is today? Almost 78% on football and men's basketball. And every year, because I've followed the finances for the last 30 years, every year the expenditures keep going up. Let me give you just one figure. This is NCAA data. From 2006 to 2010, this is the FBS, okay? What used to be 1A. The budget for our men's programs went up from $15 million to $20 million. $15 million to $20 million. And by the way, the budget for the women's went up $2 million. It's the expenditures in these two sports that are causing the loss of men's participation, and the loss of the participation slots are exclusively in Division I. They're not in Division II. They're not in Division III. And overall, I'll tell you the exact figures. In 1972, there were 170,000 participation slots for our men. Today, there are 250,000 slots. So overall, the men have not lost, but they've lost in divisions 1A particularly, and it's because of the expenditures. We're spending more than $1 million on some coaches, more than a million. In some cases, it's way more than $1 million. Where's the money going to come from? Thank you again, Troy. What you said was just right on the mark.
Pam, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, I was just going to say that budget decisions that are made often, and I have seen articles and some research that would indicate this, are made to undermine Title IX by some of the athletic, male athletic directors and others, that to bring kind of the point out that men are losing opportunities in sports because of Title IX, and that is seen as a method of getting the word out that Title IX is a problem. And I think Christine has hit the nail on the head on so many things here that I, as you saw, I was applauding silently for what she has been saying.
Troy, you and I, men in football, you gave Wisconsin a run for their money last weekend. The men's basketball team has been getting so much more attention going to the big dance. And how do you balance things out? How do you protect against that at UNI?
Well, you know, I have one advantage in that being raised in the state of Iowa, Title IX, you know, me, when I was coming up through secondary school, Title IX really was a non-factor because it was kind of the way of life that I knew. Mm-hmm. And I grew up not needing legislation to tell me what was right and wrong. That was part of the culture that I was raised in. So it's probably easier for me than it is for some who didn't grow up in that type of culture, or grew up with that philosophy, to understand that as you make decisions, you know, I make my financial decisions based on two factors. One, is it going to help our student athletes graduate and have a better experience? And secondly, am I going to help myself in the ability to generate more revenue to sustain the current operations? I don't make financial decisions based on men and women. I make decisions based on those other two factors. And I think that just goes back to the environment in the state of Iowa and the fact that I'm 46 years old and I've lived in Iowa for 46 years.
When I was watching the Olympics, I did find myself thinking, though, looking at the men's volleyball team, I thought, where do these men train? Where do they go to school? Where do they get these opportunities? Troy, do you think we're going to see some men's sports just disappear?
Well, you know, if you look around the country right now, I think the Olympic Committee would like a stronger collegiate presence in some sports. But I don't think you're going to see at the Division I level, as Christine said, I don't think you're going to see athletic directors bent to increasing the variety of opportunities as much as they're going to be bent in increasing the ability to be competitive in those two revenue-driving sports. And that is that's the difference between Division I and Divisions II and III. We're getting less and less broad-based, you know, for male opportunities at our level, and I just don't see the growth. If someone were to give me $5 million tomorrow and say, start a new sport, I would add there are one or two women's sports that are growing and evolving before any men's sports that are growing and evolving out there today.
And what sports do you come to mind when you say that?
Well, you know, lacrosse is spreading like wildfire nationally, and there are a certain number of schools who've signed on now to get triathlon as an emerging sport, and UNI has an outstanding club rugby team that hasn't gotten traction nationally, and I don't know that it will continue to be an evolving sport, but you know, I would look at a sport like rugby at our campus and say our students are engaged and involved and playing it right now. Why wouldn't that be a type of program that we would want to take forward to be a varsity level sport?
Pam, look to the future with me. What do you think needs to be done to bring us into Title IX compliance, but not just compliance? I mean, the true spirit of Title IX. What needs to happen?
Well, one of the things I was thinking is Anita DeFrance, who is actually on the board of directors for the International Olympic Committee. Once she said sports is a birthright, and I've always thought of that as something we need to look at in terms of figuring out how we can get away from regarding, and as we've heard several times, two sports, specifically in collegiate athletics, as the only and the most important way for us to get students involved. So I think we just need to back up and indicate that athletic endeavors and anything that involves physical activity keeps us all more healthy and gives us a better opportunity in various careers across the continent, across the world, and within all kinds of different industries. So I think Title IX is the way that we can continue to make progress in what we're trying to do across and around the world.
Christine, what do we need to do in the next decade to really create a society where there is equal opportunity in sports?
I think we're at a crucial crossroads right now, especially when I look at the finances. And to put it in a nutshell, I think we, especially in Division I, we either cut expenditures, which can be easily done, and I could spend an hour telling you how to do it, or we cut sports. Now, you know which way I'm going to vote. I really do think we could cut so much fat from Division I and still have a great experience for our student athletes. That's what I would like to see. And I would like to see us really try actively to get an exemption from the antitrust laws to get the salaries of coaches back into line with the professors on our university campus.
There are some people who look at football and basketball programs, men's football and basketball programs around the nation, and they say, the young men in these programs spend so much time and effort in preparing to compete that they can't really truly be student athletes. And of course, they do have to be students at the same time. Do you think that there is something about that system that is broken?
I think there is probably too much time given to athletics. But that's true not just for men's sports. That's also true for women's sports. And I'd like to see that cut back somewhat. And we could still field very highly competitive teams. You know, we're doing things excessively, both in our expectations of student athletes and also our expenditures.
Troy, we've talked about it a little bit, but as an athletic director, what would you like to have the ability to do to create a more equal playing field?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the situation that we find ourselves in today is a result of just the climate and culture of our society that has forced us to go into these particular directions. And my greatest fear, I look at our model being so different, even though we're competing at the Division I level, so different than an Iowa and Iowa State. We don't rely on television money. We don't rely basically, I don't know where the next big cash cow is for schools who are growing at 10 and 15% a year. And eventually that has to stop, and what is the day of reckoning? As an athletic director, my big goal is trying to find a way to stabilize what we've got, and I don't have my football at this level is a net break even. It doesn't generate $30+ million. I don't have financial cash cows in a program at a school like Northern Iowa. I have to find a way to make the experience good for everyone across the board and raise money externally just to survive. So for me, in looking ahead, I have to create and preserve great opportunities for men and women, and operate within the parameters, not just the way the law is written, but the intent of what Title IX says, the intent of what we're supposed to do in a society, in looking at men and women equally and making sure their opportunities are as good for one as they are the other.
Troy, thank you.
Thank you.
Troy Dannon is the Director of Athletics at the University of Northern Iowa. Pam Creedon, thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and Christine Grant, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.